You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the federal deficit has long been treated as the ticking time bomb of U.S. fiscal policy, something that's bad and should be kept as contained as possible. But we'll talk to an economist who argues that the way we think about government spending is backwards. Now, much of the time, public health officials have a low profile, but that's not the case during a global pandemic like the one we face now. Now, they're often front and center in press conferences, government meetings, and hearings, and they're called on to offer recommendations and guidance for containing the coronavirus. And many of those officials, from Dr. Anthony Fauci of the White House's Coronavirus Task Force to public health officers in small counties and cities, are facing harassment and even death threats for their positions on the steps needed to slow the spread of the virus. That includes some Wisconsin health officials who have at times borne the brunt of public frustration in local meetings and forums. Lori Tremel Freeman is the CEO at the National Association of County and City Health Officials. She previously served as the CEO of the Association of Maternal and Child Health Programs. Lori, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Before we get into the threats that some of your members are facing, can you talk about the role of county and city health officials, especially in a time like a pandemic?
Yes, sure. Our county and city health officials have been on the front lines of this pandemic response, doing the things that they always do for their communities, including monitoring the community for disease, helping to stand up testing sites, getting sick people access to care, ensuring those who are sick are isolated and quarantined. And now they're working to enforce public health orders related to opening up our cities and states and ensuring that businesses, schools, and other members of the community are aware of safe opening guidelines and just trying to do their best to ensure that they are followed.
Now, according to a representative of the Wisconsin Public Health Association here in the state, we've heard public health officials have been called names at public meetings and been compared to Hitler, have received profanity-laced emails and voicemails, have had to be escorted from meetings with some police to protect them, and there have been calls and emails criticizing them for opening up their communities too fast, saying they hope the health officer gets COVID and see how sick they get. Is that the kind of thing you're hearing from members around the country?
Yes, we've been hearing threats coming in different ways. Individuals are being targeted for simply carrying out their work, trying to keep their communities safe and healthy. And those examples include physical threats. In some cases, public health offices are being vandalized. And in one extreme case, a Facebook group is targeting all local health officials.
Right. The organization of these efforts, there's some national groups, there's some local groups organizing campaigns against local public health officials. Sometimes those have threats of violence contained within them. Are people worried about this, people working in these jobs?
Yes, of course. They're worried for themselves. They're worried for their families. They're worried for their staffs. They're worried, yes.
Have we seen people actually quit, resign their jobs as a result of threats like this?
Yes, we have. Unfortunately, we're seeing an increasing trend across the country of public health department officials leaving their jobs. And as near as we can tell, nearly 30 have either resigned, been fired, or taken early retirement. All for just trying to protect and defend the health of their community in responding to the COVID-19 pandemic.
We're talking to Lori Tremel Freeman with the National Association of County and City Health Officials, talking about threats that local health officials have faced around the country, often in reaction to things like mask mandates or business shutdowns, that kind of thing. Lori, what would you say to members of the public who, you know, maybe frustrated, maybe have their reasons for not liking a mask mandate or for shutdown orders or for reopening orders, that matter? What would you say to them about how to express those views without threatening their local public health officer?
Well, I mean, freedom of expression is your right. There's no need to be violent or threaten violence. Everybody has a right to speak out. But I would tell them, too, that you know, our public health officials are the people in our communities who have been trusted people to go to for advice in the past, and they don't have any particular political stance In the past, if your public health authority told you to boil your water, I don't think very many people would have questioned, should I boil my water to keep from getting sick? No, of course not. You know, the same holds true for the advice that our public health officials are giving now. They're just trying to keep you safe by telling you to wear your mask and to distance yourself from others and to wash your hands. This is not a political stance. This is just about keeping yourself healthy and those around you healthy. It's as simple as safety.
What happens if experienced public health officials continue to leave their positions at a higher than usual rate as this pandemic goes on because of these threats?
Well, we really can't afford to lose our public health officials in this way. And at this time, our public health officials are working very, very hard, extended hours, and for a long period of time to ensure that this disease passes safely and that we were able to mitigate the spread of it. We need their leadership at this time during pandemic. We can't afford to have gaps in the workforce at the local level when we're trying to stop the spread of this disease and to get our lives back to normal.
There's not much that's ordinary about the current pandemic, but is this something you've seen happen in the past where people react this strongly against their local public health officials?
Well, I mean, there have been times over the years when there has been a public health issue and we've had to respond to it with the Flint lead crisis. We have natural disasters that require a public health response at times. And so this is a longer-term event, and we haven't seen anything like this in over 100 years. But with this pandemic, it's all hands on deck to address the disease and to keep the level of sustained effort required to stay on top of the work. It's incredibly resource-intensive. So we really do need to have our public health leaders and their staff in place working on our behalf to help keep us all healthy.
When we do get back to normal or something close to it, and hopefully that's not too far off, what kind of priorities do you have when it comes to the needs of local public health officials?
Well, we need sustained infrastructure. You know, the local health departments came into this response really at a deficit. Over the past 10 years or so, they've lost a lot of their funding. The public health, governmental public health function from the federal, the state to the local level has been consistently reduced in funding and defunded over that period. And that infrastructure has slowly been wearing away. And so when we came into this response, we were truly at a deficit even then, you know, to respond to COVID-19. So we need to rebuild that infrastructure. We need to have that as a priority at all the federal agency levels through our Congress so that our American people are protected from threats like this. And only by restoring that infrastructure permanently are we going to feel the safety that we need to feel from future diseases like this.
Lori, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Lori Trumbull Freeman is the CEO at the National Association of County and City Health Officials. She was with us to talk about threats and harassment being aimed at some local public health officials around the country because of their role in efforts to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Coming up, thousands of rail crossings around the country lack the safety features recommended by state and federal officials. We'll hear about a push to get them installed along one rail line here in Wisconsin. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out about the push to get safety features installed at railroad crossings between Plymouth and Kohler after trains started running there for the first time in decades. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a profile of a Wisconsin musician who's just released a new EP.
Musician Madison Malone got her start at 16, playing in her uncle's bar in Portage for $50 and a slice of pizza. That was followed by gigs at community festivals, and eventually she dove into the Madison music scene while she was a student at University of Wisconsin. Now, the singer-songwriter is making moves in Los Angeles. WPR's Sarah Hopeful caught up with Malone to talk about her new EP and the simple love that helped influence it.
It's weird. I always know when I'm going to write a song that I actually like because I feel like I have a headache. I don't have a headache, but I'm annoyed. And I feel like somebody's poking me with a stick and I don't know what's happening. But then a song will come out and I'm like, oh, I was trying to like birth the creation. That's what that was.
Like the feeling you get before you sneeze.
Yes. Yep. That. Exactly.
Love it.
Mm-hmm.
Quiet down. Keep it low. No need to tell them who you are. Wear the mask. They won't know if you love them or him or her. I don't believe that love could be a sin.
Okay, most proud of lyric, quiet down. I mean, I guess the chorus is a short chorus, but like, want to show you all of me, give you everything, this is not easy, is me talking about coming out and being pansexual, which just means you love people for people, doesn't matter their gender, you just love humans.
Want to show you
And I'm proud of that because I've known that my whole life, but it wasn't really until I moved to LA where I, one, accepted it within myself, and two, was able to live it, because I feel like everybody in LA doesn't care. Nobody cares. It's like if your hair is purple, it's more interesting. Like, oh, you have a girlfriend? Don't care. Your hair is purple? Wow. Where did you do that? Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, it's so cool.
Tell me about Simple Love.
Oh, Simple Love is my favorite song on the whole EP. The story of this is I saw a tree and I thought it was so beautiful. I took a picture of the tree and I sent it to my girlfriend and I told her I wanted to marry her under that tree. Then I went to take a shower and I'm sitting in that meditative state that we all get into. And all I could hear in my head was, I want to marry you under a tree. That's the line. That thing came up and I thought, oh, hey, hey, that's a song.
I want to marry you under a tree, saying our vows in front of family. Oh, I want to marry you under a tree.
And I got out, turned the water off, like quick dried off, wrote it all down. And I kind of just told the love story that I want. And it's also the love story that I've witnessed with my parents and with certain other people, of just a simple love. Like, life can be crazy, but when you go back at the end of the day, you have that person to go home to. You can lay next to somebody in bed who's a solid human individual.
Oh, it's really a simple love. Oh, it's really a simple love.
And we are getting married.
Yes.
Under a tree.
I want to be buried right next to you, beneath that old tree where we first said I do. I want to be buried right next to you.
That was WPR producer Sarah Hopeful talking with musician Madison Malone. She has a new EP out titled 1 and 2. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, if you picture a railroad crossing, chances are the image includes safety equipment, stuff like a gate or flashing lights. But many railroad crossings don't have those features, which can put drivers at risk. And after trains started running on Wisconsin's Plymouth to Kohler rail line after almost 30 years, one collision and other near misses led to a push to get those safety measures installed at its six road crossings. Peyton Guyon is an investigative reporter with New Jersey Advanced Media. He spent 9 months in Wisconsin as the O'Brien Fellow in Public Service Journalism at Marquette University. He's looked into safety at railroad crossings across the country. Peyton, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Before we dig into this particular rail line here in Wisconsin that you focused on in a piece that appeared in the Journal Sentinel, can you tell us about this wider issue around the country? We've got a fair amount of lines. They come back into action, and they don't always get the safety stuff we expect.
Sure. So the project I was working on was a national look at railroad crossing safety. And what I had come across a few years back was just that this was kind of an issue that, since railroad crossings are all over the country, anyone who drives regularly drives over them all the time. And the sort of they kind of go to the back of our mind. Safety is not the first thing that we think about. And so what I started noticing was there were several issues where crossing safety was not one of the biggest considerations made, in many cases where it should be and where federal guidelines suggest it should be. And that's something where this Plymouth-Kohler line that was put back in service kind of came up. I wanted a local story as part of the project. I was working with some students at Marquette, and you know, this issue in Plymouth came to our attention, and we had to dig in.
All right, give us the history of this Plymouth-Kohler line and how it came back into action.
Sure, and this kind of this is sort of a microcosm of the ebbs and flows of the railroad industry as a whole. So back in the 19th century, the late 19th century, the line was set up more as a commuter line. It would take, you know, it's the passenger line, passenger line. But as the car kind of rose and less people started taking the train as a form of transportation, it switched to freight. But then by the late 70s, early 80s, that business had kind of dried up as the rail industry as a whole was going through some economic challenges and some consolidations. And then so some of the secondary or tertiary lines like Plymouth to Kohler, were sort of out of use. And that's where state government, local government sort of stepped up and started raising the money to put these lines back in service just as a way for economic preservation, making sure, you know, businesses in rural parts of states that didn't have a primary rail line weren't just completely isolated from freight transportation.
All right. So here comes the Plymouth-Kohler line back into action. What did it take to take that dormant line and bring trains on it again?
So in as a monetary figure, took right about $20 million. And this came both from, it was primarily state money, both in loans and grants. But it also came as part of some local funding was raised, $2 or $3 million, both from Sheboygan County, Plymouth, Sheboygan Falls, and then there were some local businesses that stood to benefit from the line reopening that also pitched in a little bit of money. So about $20 million is what it took financially. Sort of practically speaking, there were crossings that had actually rails had been ripped from the road. The tracks were no longer there. So there was some installation that had to happen at some of these crossings. And that was, you know, one of the things that just seemed sort of crazy to me is that they would put these tracks back in the road where for almost three decades, drivers had not, you know, had grown accustomed to not seeing trains. Trains, in fact, could not run there when the rails weren't there. But they reopened these lines this line without proper safety equipment.
And you talked to some local residents about near misses and incidents there. What kind of things did you hear?
I mean, it was almost without fail. I took my students. I had three students that were working with me at Marquette University on this project. Two of them came up with me in December just to, you know, kind of do some on the ground reporting. So we spent the day just driving around to these different crossings, knocking on doors, talking to neighbors. And I think we probably spoke to 12, 15 different people, and all but one just told us that, you know, repeatedly they had either with their own eyes seen or talk to, you know, neighbors about seeing, you know, people coming across the tracks without slowing down and almost getting hit by a train. And it's, you know, the fact that trains don't even run all that often on the line, you know, two or three times a week trains are coming through, for just about everybody to have a story like that in only a few years' time just struck us as really problematic.
And these are road crossings with, as I understand it, no signal, no bar, not much of anything. Was that what local officials had in mind when they ponied up to help pay for this thing?
So we talked to a few local officials who, you know, when they were first thinking about it, they were thinking about the economic benefits of it. You know, being able to tell residents and businesses, you know, that they were going to have access to rail transport or to freight transportation via the railroad. And so, you know, the former city manager of Plymouth, who has since left his job to take another one somewhere else in the country, told us that, you know, they were all thinking about it on the 30,000 foot level, and kind of the safety they left to the Wisconsin Office of the Commissioner of Railroads, the Wisconsin DOT. And it sort of, by the time, you know, it got finished, it was like, oh my gosh, we don't have anything protecting these drivers from trains.
is there any kind of effort out there, especially at the most used crossings you looked at, to get some safety measures in place?
Yeah, so what Plymouth did was they hired a consultant to come in, and this is a guy who worked for the Wisconsin Office of the Commissioner of Railroads, essentially the state rail regulator, had worked for them for years, and he had retired and came in as a consultant, and he recommended that of the six crossings in Plymouth that had been reopened, five needed flashing lights and automatic gates, and of course none have them. So, in considering this petition, the state did agree to upgrade one, but it had to wait until 2023, just because that's when the funding would be available to it. So the town was really left, to take care of the problem itself. And in January, they approved a flashing stop sign at one of the crossings that had been problematic that we brought up in our story. But the flashing stop sign, even if that is an improvement, still doesn't quite meet what the town was asking for, and in many cases, what federal regulations recommend.
In our last minute, Peyton, this is Plymouth, Wisconsin. Is this something that local officials elsewhere in the country are struggling with right now, how to make these crossings at least a little safer?
And if we're talking about the wider issue as opposed to, instead of simply when these lines are reopened, I mean, absolutely. I think a lot of your listeners will probably think that crossings that don't have flashing lights and gates are probably not used. And that's not the case whatsoever. It's something like 40% of all railroad crossings in the entire country do not have any active warning devices, will not warn you when a train is coming. This is something local officials often fight with both state departments of transportation and the railroads themselves to try to get upgraded. And unfortunately, not enough is getting done.
Peyton, thanks a lot for sharing your reporting with us today.
Really appreciate you guys having me. Thanks so much.
That's Peyton Guyon, investigative reporter with the New Jersey Advance Media. He's a former O'Brien Fellow in Public Service Journalism at Marquette University. He talked to us about an effort to get safety features installed at railroad crossings in the Plymouth area and how it fits into the issue of railroad safety nationwide. Coming up, we'll talk to an economist who says the federal government should be running a deficit for the good of our nation. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests take a look at small businesses around the state and find out how they are trying to recover from the impact of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Congress passed the Federal CARES Act in March, putting $2 trillion into the economy in an effort to recover from the economic damage of the COVID-19 pandemic. That move added significantly to our federal deficit, which had already been rising by an unusual amount during a generally positive economy. Members of both major political parties criticize the deficit, especially when the other party is in power. But our next guest says we need to rethink the role of deficits, and sometimes they're not big enough. Stephanie Kelton is a professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University. She's the author of the book, The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. Stephanie, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
Well, let's dive right into this idea, modern monetary theory. We see it thrown around sometimes in political discussions. Can you give us the Cliff's Notes version of what it is?
Sure. Well, it's basically helping us to kind of update our lens, if you like. Like, we need a new prescriptive lens because we are having too many political debates. Too much of the discourse is taking place as if we're still basically on a gold standard when the monetary system has undergone a significant change. It happened back in 1971 when President Nixon closed the gold window and the dollar became untethered, no longer tied to gold. And so we have today what's called a fiat currency, a floating exchange rate. And the basic idea is that this opens up a great deal of policy space, having a currency that is no longer tied to the gold standard, to gold. And that for the most part, Too often we have debates where we ask questions like, you know, how are you going to pay for that when someone wants to expand an existing program or introduce a new spending program? We say, where are you going to find the money? Well, where are you going to find the money is very much, you know, hearkening back to the gold standard, as if somebody needs to go, you know, dig something out of the ground somewhere in order to come up with the money to pay for things. So we're just trying to help people get a better understanding of how the monetary system works and the options that are available under the system that we have, and, you know, why we fail to take full advantage of the monetary system to build a better economy for everybody.
Let's dive into the national deficit and the overall debt. You know, a lot of times, as I said, politicians of both parties don't like having big deficits. They don't like the growing debt. And there's the analogy, well, you couldn't run a household this way. You couldn't run a city or state or business this way. You'd go bankrupt. And you make the case actually in your first chapter that no, if you can issue your own currency, you're fundamentally different than that household or that business with their budget. Why is that?
Well, because, and you're exactly right. One of us is different from the others, and the federal government is fundamentally different from you and I, from a household, from a private business, or even from state and local governments. And the key distinction is that the federal government is the issuer of our currency, the U.S. dollar. They have the sole legal authority to issue the U.S. dollar. If I try to create the thing, you know, and I get caught, it's called counterfeiting, and it's against the law, and I'm going to end up in an orange jumpsuit. If governors could issue the currency, they would not be desperately pleading with Congress right now to help them. They are hemorrhaging tax revenue. They are in dire straits. They're laying off public sector workers. They can't continue to operate their budgets unless they get help from the federal government. Only the currency issuer can provide the funding to state and local governments to help prop up small businesses and larger corporations, entire industries like the cruise lines and the airlines, retail, restaurants, and so forth. It's the currency issuer who is different from everybody else.
There's a fundamental kind of mental mindset that I think you're looking to change for a lot of people. I think, again, harkening back to the gold standard, but even now, this idea that a dollar bill represents something, its value is based on something, and it seems like it's more of, in the modern monetary theory concept, I don't know, like a mental construct that we can use to keep score of our economy. Help me sort that out.
Well, it is that, and it is also a tax credit. And so you can think of the dollars that you have in your pocket. The government does not promise to, if you hand the government a $10 bill, they don't promise you some amount of gold. They don't promise to convert it into anything real at a fixed price. What they'll do is give you 2 fives or 10 ones. But what they'll also do is reduce your tax liability by $10. So the U.S. dollar is a tax credit, and the fundamental obligation of the government as the issuer of the currency is to accept that currency back in payment to itself. So all of us can use that currency to settle our tax obligations at the end of the year, April 15th or whenever that kind of moving deadline now happens to be. But, you know, the government uses the monetary system to get the rest of us to work and produce things for the state so that we can have some public goods, so that we can have, you know, highways, and so that we can have hospitals, and so that we can have an army, a national defense. There are a number of public goods that we collectively produce for the state in exchange for the state's currency, which is then useful to us in settling our obligations with the federal government.
Talking to Stephanie Kelton, economist and author of the new book, The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. Stephanie, if say, the United States government agreed with you, yes, we're going with this modern monetary theory, we're not going to base our spending and taxing decisions on our concerns over the deficit, what could that look like?
Well, just look at what Congress has been doing. Right? Since March, since the coronavirus took hold and Congress began to act, so far the House has passed 5 pieces of legislation. The Senate has gone along with 4 of those, and the largest you referred to just a little while ago when you talked about the CARES Act. That's the biggest piece of legislation that has gotten through both houses of Congress and signed into law. That's the CARES Act. That's $2.2 trillion. Okay, and so Congress is doing precisely what we've been talking about. They committed to spending money they quote unquote did not have. They didn't go out and raise taxes and collect a bunch of dollars from you and from me and from struggling businesses. They didn't go ask China if it would be okay if maybe they could help, you know, lend us $2.2 trillion. Congress is the issuer, right? They have the power of the purse. The federal government is the issuer of the currency. It can commit to spending dollars it does not have, unlike state and local governments we talked about earlier. So the answer to your question is they're doing it now. And thank God that they have that power, because can you imagine what it would be like if we were on a gold standard and we didn't have a monetary system that was nimble enough to allow Congress to respond quickly and aggressively to an unfolding economic crisis like the one that we're currently fighting against.
And then a common objection would be, well, wait a minute, if they're spending money they don't have, don't they have to reckon with that sometime? Or isn't a bill going to come due?
Well, no, not really. What they're doing is they're making payments, and they're making payments in a currency, again, that they and only they can issue. Now, some of that currency, some of those dollars that find their way into people's hands as the government spends, get recycled, and they become U.S. treasuries. And, you know, we could have probably a long discussion about what that really looks like and what it entails. We refer to it as government borrowing. We say that those treasuries are part of the national debt. I think both of those descriptions are really unhelpful. I think they confuse people. They're not accurately describing what's actually taking place. Government isn't borrowing in the same way that you and I would borrow. If we charge up our credit card or we go to the bank and take out a loan, we're really on the hook. We've got to earn or somehow come up with the money ultimately to pay back those loans. The government is basically deciding to make some of its payments in the form of interest-bearing currency. And that's what U.S. government bonds are. They're dollars that pay interest. Congress chooses to do that. It wouldn't have to, but it's choosing to make some of its payments that way. Our problem is that we use a label to refer to all of those outstanding government bonds. We call it the national debt. And that word then creates a lot of anxiety, unnecessarily, I believe, in the American people. There's nothing inherently risky about what's taking place. What you would want to pay attention to is whether Congress is providing too much fiscal support. Too many dollars are falling into the hands of people, and some of those are interest-bearing dollars, and that could potentially lead to inflation. But I would argue that Congress is not doing too much at the moment. They're doing too little.
We're talking to Stephanie Kelton right now, professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University. Her new book is called The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the ideas you've heard so far or about how modern monetary theory works? Do you think the government should be spending more money, especially right now with a risky economy because of coronavirus? Or do you think the government should focus on reducing the annual deficit? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Stephanie Kelton, professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University. She's with us to talk about her new book. It's called The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the national deficit? What do you think about this idea that we should worry less about the deficit? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Stan is with us in De Pere. Stan, hi.
Yeah, hi. A question for your guest. What percentage of the federal budget currently is just to pay the interest on our debt? And what will that look like a year from now with, you know, decreased tax revenue and increased government spending? Because I'm a little worried that I have a lot of credit cards in my wallet. I can live really great for a couple of years if I max out them cards. But eventually the bill comes due. So that's what I'm worried about.
Stan, thanks for the call, Stephanie. The debt service payments that we're already making.
Yeah, it's a concern for many, many people. I'll say a couple of things. It is, well, currently something less than 3% is the current number in terms of the share of the total federal government budget. Now, there are, you know, projections out there, and these can get lawmakers very exercised because they can look at, you know, a report that says eventually we're going to be spending more on interest than we're spending on national defense or something. So they see this as, you know, they're looking at it like the federal government's budget is a household budget. So when they see the interest expense piece rising, they think it's kind of like your cable bill. You know, if you have a fixed amount that you can spend every month and all of your income is accounted for, it all goes somewhere, and one line item in your budget becomes more expensive, your rent goes up, your cable bill goes up, it crowds out other things, right? It means you have less money to spend on everything else. But the federal government's budget doesn't work that way. So that's the first point. Congress can always choose to spend more on education or infrastructure or anything else, even if one item in its budget is increasing, like interest, for example. The other point, and I think it's more important, is that a currency-issuing government like the United States never has to borrow its own currency from anyone. Okay, the borrowing piece is purely voluntary. It's something Congress chooses to do, but it's not imperative. Think about it. If you could issue the U.S. dollar, would you ever worry? Would you ever worry about needing to borrow it from anyone? Okay, the government doesn't have to do that first. Second, if it chooses to make U.S. treasuries available, government bonds, so that savers can have an interest-bearing way to hold on to their dollars, it can always choose the interest rate that it wants to compensate savers. So that's another piece of this. The third piece is that those interest payments are income. If you are fortunate enough to hold some of those government bonds, well, you know, congratulations, you're receiving a risk-free reward because government bonds are default risk-free, but they pay a reward in the form of interest income. So every year you're getting additional dollars layered on top of your initial investment. So there are a lot of different ways to think about that, but I think that most of the things that get people excited about the interest are really not cause for concern.
Just in our last couple minutes, I want to bring on one more caller. Charles is with us in Eau Claire. Charles, hi.
Hi there. I wanted to ask the guest if increasing the supply of money to the United States people changes the value of the dollar, and by doing that, is there advantages to that? Is there disadvantages?
Does it dilute the dollar in our last couple of minutes?
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, you can look at what the central bank, for example, what the Fed has been doing just since 2008 from the financial crisis. You know, they did all these rounds of something called quantitative easing, which people said characterized as printing money. And now the Fed is doing it again, right? Buying lots and lots of financial assets to help support corporations and businesses and financial markets. But central banks around the world are doing this. So there isn't an inherent dilution of the value of the dollar. It doesn't pose an inherent risk in terms of inflation or anything like that. In fact, it turns out it's pretty hard to cause inflation. Central banks around the world have spent the last number of decades, in some cases, in the case of Japan, three decades, trying to push the inflation rate up to 2% and struggling to do it. We haven't been able to get inflation up to a robust 2% here in the U.S. Europe has been struggling. So inflation is a tricky phenomenon, and it isn't very easy, it turns out, to get inflation going.
Thanks a lot for that call, and we'll leave it there for now. Stephanie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me back.
That's Stephanie Kelton, professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University. She's the author of the book, The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. And you could still keep sharing your thoughts on the ideas she shared here and on the U.S. deficit and debt in general over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Since the Black Lives Matter marches began in late May, attention turned to a Wauwatosa police officer named Joseph Mensa. During his 5 years with the police department there, Mensa has fatally shot three men of color. Corrine Hess reports.
Last week, the Anderson family and Black Lives Matter protesters went to Madison Park in Wauwatosa. Jay Anderson is calling for the firing of police officer Joseph Mensa.
The way he executed my son, y'all, how he executed all of them, really. I mean, this man just don't care about nothing. I don't know what he care about.
Jay Anderson Jr. was the second of three people Mensa has killed since becoming a police officer in 2015. All of the victims were young men of color. Mensa is black. Jay's mom, Linda, says Mensa belongs in jail.
And I need all y'all support to do this. We can't do it by ourselves. And I just want to fight for him until we can't fight no more.
Linda remembers running errands with Jay 4 years ago and picking up cousin subs for the family the night he died.
He was happy. Then we all came home and we sat in our living room and his daughter was walking around eating off of everybody's subs.
Around midnight, Anderson told his fiance he was going to meet some friends to celebrate his upcoming birthday. Anderson would have turned 26 on July 4th. Surveillance video shows Anderson parking his car in Madison Park around 1:30 a.m. Mensa tapped on Anderson's passenger side window at 3 a.m. According to the DA's report, Mensa noticed Anderson had a gun in the passenger seat. Mensa drew his weapon and ordered Anderson's hands up. Anderson raised his hands and then lowered them four times. The fourth time, Mensa fired. Mensa turned on his squad camera after the shooting. Toxicology reports found Anderson to be legally intoxicated. In July 2015, Mensa and his partner fatally shot Antonio Gonzalez. The 29-year-old was wielding a sword. Friends and family have said that weapon was decorative. Mensa was also the police officer who fatally shot 17-year-old Alvin Cole in a mall parking lot in February. Police say Cole fired a gun at them before the shooting. Mensa was cleared by the Milwaukee County District Attorney in the first two shootings. The Cole case is under review. The Anderson and Cole families have hired attorney Kimberly Motley. She doesn't believe Anderson was reaching for his gun and wants that case reopened.
Murder does not have a statute of limitations. And so I think it's appropriate to relook at this case, especially in light of the fact that it is the same officer.
Motley grew up in Milwaukee, but has spent years working on human rights cases in Afghanistan. She says police officers killing people of color is also a human rights issue.
And so because of that, I felt compelled to come back to my hometown and to address this human rights issue and to represent the Cole family.
The Wauwatosa Police Department did not respond to requests for comment. In a recent Facebook post, Chief Barry Weber says Mensa used deadly force to defend himself. Motley points out there have been no other citizens shot by Wauwatosa police officers since 2015, and that's not unusual. John Shane is a former police captain and an associate professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He says most police officers in the United States never shoot anybody.
And one police officer is involved in three deadly force encounters. I couldn't even begin to tell you how far away from the average that would be. It is extremely, extremely rare.
On June 18th, Motley filed a complaint with the Wauwatosa Police and Fire Commission seeking Mensa's termination. The group has 30 days to respond. The Anderson and Cole families and the protesters say that while the outcome may be legal, it won't be just, and they plan to continue to seek justice. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. According to new surveys, Americans are unhappy with happiness levels at a 50-year low. A researcher on our emotional well-being joins the show to talk about our national mood, what has led us here, and what it might take to get out of that. And, of course, we'll ask for your thoughts along the way. Also tomorrow, Reggie the Real Critic is back for some movie talk with a serious theme. Reggie's going to share some great movies that tackle issues of race and give great pictures of the lives of African Americans. Plus, we'll find out why Wisconsin is a tough state for college students to vote in. We'll check out a new report about that. That and a look at some of the top news stories, state and national, of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, from service berries to dandelion greens, find out about great foods to forage in Wisconsin this time of year. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the White House is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn the Affordable Care Act. We'll talk about the latest legal challenge to Obamacare and what it can mean for Americans in the midst of a pandemic. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.